Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. This month we feature a story by Con Lehane, who has produced two mystery series at novel length, the Brian McNulty novels, starring a New York City bartender turned sleuth, and the 42nd Street Library series, featuring a crime fiction collection curator. Though he now lives in the Washington, D.C. area, the author usually chooses a setting in or near his native New York City for his fiction. The story he reads here is no exception. It first appeared in the September-October 2017 issue of EQMM in our Black Mask department. It's a classic noir story following a character with no clearly good options who crosses a dangerous moral boundary. Here is Con Lehane with his story, Come Back, Patty Riley.
Patty Riley was undercover, working narcotics in the 20th Precinct, on the street as he had been when he first joined the force, setting up a score that would bring down a dealer named Larry Porter. Drugs were rampant again on the streets, and the task force honchos thought Patty would fit into the new drug scene, as he had in the old days. Little did they know. It should have gone down easily, but everything fell apart in Larry Porter's apartment in the early afternoon, a couple of days before the bust. That afternoon, after setting up the sale, Patty followed Porter along a narrow hallway into a living room, and there, curled up on a couch in the corner like a Persian cat, was a young woman dressed in white with reddish-brown hair, a halo in front of her eyes, and a bashful smile. Patty Riley froze, thinking memory had tricked him. She'd never grown older. Her face was childlike. It couldn't be, so he looked again. Aha, said Larry. Gorgeous, ain't she? Come on and meet Nancy. So it was her. He introduced himself as Pat Grace, putting together a story in his mind in case she recognized him. Even if she did, she wouldn't know he was a cop. He hadn't seen Nancy in over 20 years. He was pushing his luck. Larry Porter, a thick-necked, light-skinned black man whose massive chest and shoulder strength was beginning to round somewhat into middle-age portliness, was a guy you walked lightly around. He made no effort to hide the .32 in the holster strapped to his leg just above his ankle. Patty was unarmed. Staying longer in the apartment than he had to was insane. He should clear out. But he was so thrilled at finding Nancy, he couldn't. So if they make me, I'm dead, he said to himself. He shook her hand and then stood back and absorbed her smile. You're new, Nancy said. New to you, said Patty. Larry keeps you a secret. White shirt, white slacks, her feet tucked under her, her hair the reddish-brown color it had been the first time he saw her. The same shocking red lipstick. She hadn't changed at all, except for telltale pinpoint pupils in her coal black eyes. Instinctively, he looked at her arms for the crook of the arm inside the elbow, but the sleeves of her blouse reached to her wrists. A toot, Larry Porter suggested. Patty hesitated. He developed 1,000 excuses over the years, so it wasn't that. Oh, come on, said Nancy. Why not, said Patty. From a leather pouch sitting on a large wooden coffee table in front of Nancy, Porter took a quart Ziploc freezer bag half filled with cocaine. Worth a couple of grand, Patty calculated, while Porter spooned a generous amount into a black plastic grinder the size and shape of a lady's compact and turned the top. Ever base it, Larry asked. This stuff's the best, better than you've ever tasted. I like to snort. You'll ruin your nose, said Nancy. I already have. Neosinephrine, Larry said. He scooped some of the finely ground white powder out of the box with a silver spoon and handed it to Patty. Patty shoveled it into one nostril, handed the spoon back to Larry, who refilled it for the other nostril. It was good coke. A rush like a locomotive. He watched Nancy burst into bloom. In a couple of seconds, he was flying, not scared of anything, in love with everyone, especially her. "A speedball?" Nancy asked, after the numbness set in and they'd listened to loud jazz for some time. Perky and flirtatious, she was a charming hostess. "Great," said Patty, floating in the twilight zone, warning bells clanging dully in the distance. Nancy mixed Coke and a couple of pinches of a brownish powder from a foil wrapper and spread it onto a small mirror, chopping and forming the concoction into lines with a single-edged razor blade. "Uptown, downtown, pretty cool, huh?" Her dark eyes danced. She watched Patty snort the mixture, then excused herself and headed for the bathroom, where she'd cook and shoot her own concoction. Before long, she was back, pin-eyed, moving languidly, her expression dreamy. They listened to Miles Davis from 3-foot-high stereo speakers in the softly carpeted room and talked about jazz clubs and the musicians they'd seen at the Vanguard, Sweet Basil's, or another of the downtown jazz clubs. "Larry never takes me to hear rock and roll," Nancy complained. "Just jazz and disco, disco this and disco that." She laughed, a sweet musical sound. "Come on, baby, you know that ain't true." Larry turned a long-suffering look toward Patty. "We go hear jazz all the time, man. Good jazz. This woman don't know nothing about music. All she knows is rock and roll." "We were raised on it," Patty said, realizing with a shudder before the words left his mouth he shouldn't have. He'd been joking with Larry and Nancy, good-naturedly flirting with her. But something clicked when he said this. Her eyes came into focus for a second, her brow furrowed. She tilted her head and looked at him like a confused pup. Good thing she was high. She drifted away. He had to get out of there. He was going to really screw up if he didn't. Just for the way he couldn't take his eyes off of Nancy, he could get himself killed, let alone if he blew his cover. When Nancy began nodding, he and Larry watched over her like Mom and Pop seeing the baby off to sleep. Languidly, she opened her eyes every few seconds, smiled at them until heavy-lidded, her eyes closed once more. She'd gone back to the bathroom, and the second time must have done straight heroin. Before he left, when Larry Porter was seeing him off at the door, he slipped Patty an inch-long waxed paper packet. "Here, man, this'll help you party. I'll see you tomorrow night if the dude comes through." Patty laughed. "He'll come through, man. $30,000 is bus fare for this guy." Larry Porter laughed, too. He'd fallen in love with her when she and Stoop, when they were 13. She wore black denim pants and a motorcycle jacket, lavender eyeshadow, and very red lipstick. Shy as she was bold, she leaned against the wall in the entryway of Mrs. Sheehan's apartment. "So you're Patty Riley," she said, and he stopped. "Hmm." Her eyelashes fluttered, a lopsided smile on her face. "What's so special about you?" He turned red and cursed boy crazy Mary Sheehan, and, to cover his embarrassment, pulled a crumpled pack of Lucky Strikes from his pants pocket. "Nothing special about me." He snapped open the foil top of the pack and took out a bent and flattened cigarette. Nancy sauntered over to him. Standing very close, she touched his hand on the pack. "Can I have one?" He pulled out another twisted cigarette. She hesitated. "Is that your last one?" "It's okay." Eyeing the card player as he moved back a couple of steps. "Maybe we should go out on the stoop." Nancy shrugged but followed him out the door. "Your old man don't let you smoke, huh?" She sat down on the top step of the stoop. Leaning forward, she wriggled out of her leather jacket. Her bra pushed against her t-shirt, and the shirt slipped up out of her pants as she stretched. "You have permission to smoke?" he asked when she was settled. "My ma don't care." They stayed on the stoop listening to the radio through the window, the Diamonds singing Little Darling, the Coasters with Searching, Alan Freed calling the shots. Below them, beyond the stone wall at the end of the street where Naples Terrace dead-ended and the hill dropped like a cliff to Broadway, buses, cars, and trucks nosed in among the L-pillars, and the neon lights of the bars and stores blinked and glittered. The sounds of Broadway, the screech and clatter of the L-train, the throaty wheezing of the buses, an occasional car horn, the sound of traffic like a mechanized wind seemed to Patty Riley in his memory now, peaceful, like forest sounds in the night might seem to a camper. It was the Irish Bronx of his youth, a peaceful, idyllic time, except for what happened with Nancy. She was different from the Irish American kids like him in the neighborhood. For one thing, she didn't have a father at home. Her mother was different too, younger than Patty's mother and Mrs. Sheehan, and she was American. The distinguishing thing about Nancy's mother, though, was that she went out with men, quite a few men, and was therefore not spoken to or of by the Irish women, at least not in front of the children. Later, he and Nancy walked down to Broadway in the company of Mary Sheehan. They walked down the 231st Street Hill, past young men wearing light summer slacks and short-sleeved open-collared shirts, standing in clusters, leaning against parked cars. Patty felt self-conscious, noticing the eerie way the men quieted to watch Nancy walk by, pretending not to. Nancy, without looking at Patty, by some change in her stance or carriage, by the nonchalant hunch of her shoulders, gave Patty to know that she too was conscious of the stares. They bought cigarettes at the candy store next to Arthur's Diner, where the gnarled, slow-moving man who stood not much taller than his display cases didn't care about age. They drank egg creams and read Archie comics, with Patty gerrymandering the seating to sit next to Nancy, reading Archie over her shoulder and smelling her hair. On the way home, they smoked cigarettes and laughed about the old man in the store. Nancy had stolen two comic books, and Patty had grabbed a Spalding. "He hates kids anyway," said Nancy, "the old bastard." Back at the Sheehan's, they read comics and watched TV, the Late Show, and then the Late Late Show, on into the night, until Nancy fell asleep on the floor with the sound of the card players behind them. Late in the night, in the small hours of the morning, Nancy rolled onto her back and opened her eyes, then sat up, her lips compressed, her brow wrinkled, her expression startled. For a second, Patty thought she was mad at him, but she smiled dreamily, and when she lay back down, she put her head in his lap. For a week, he thought about her, reliving every moment of that night. When Friday night came again, the Pinnacle game was at the Riley's apartment. And there in the doorway, cheerful and awkward as a Christmas pup, the last one in the door, ready to turn and run at the first loud noise, her eyes sweeping the room and brightening when they settled on Patty. There in the doorway was Nancy. Her face was bright and she bowed her head timidly when Mrs. Sheehan introduced her to Patty's mother. But the brightness faded and the expression in her eyes hardened when Mrs. Riley looked chillingly down at her and back at Patty. Like a warden, Mrs. Riley watched over them. They waited until she was busy making tea for the card players to sneak away from her and Mary Sheehan down to the basement of the building, where they smoked cigarettes in a narrow, long-ceilinged room Patty's father had coaxed away from the super to beat Patty's gym. Roped off now into a boxing ring with a speed bag in the corner. "Your ma don't like me," Nancy said. She placed her hand on Patty's again as he lit her cigarette, and he could feel his heart pounding. "She's like that with most of my friends," he said. "She shouldn't not like me. She don't even know me." "Who was that girl?" his mother asked when everyone had gone. "Her name is Nancy." How old is she? His mother sounded almost disinterested as she washed the small plates and teacups left from the card player's tea. Patty heard the undertones. Nancy barely spoke to him after they'd come up from the cellar, and he'd not known what to say to her. Now she was gone, and he knew he wouldn't see her again. He didn't answer. What were you doing in the cellar? I was looking for something. With her? What's a girl that young doing with that lipstick on? She looks ridiculous. Patty got up from the kitchen table. I hope you're not spending your time with the likes of her, his mother said in the tone she used to put an end to things. You don't even know her. I know enough of her. He was 16 when he saw Nancy for the last time, again on the Sheehan stoop, on another summer night, 2 days after John F. Kennedy passed through the Irish Bronx, drumming up support in his campaign for the Democratic nomination for president. Nancy broke up with her boyfriend, Mary Sheehan had told Patty when she served him a hamburger and a Coke at Arthur's Diner a half hour after the motorcade had roared down Broadway. She asked me about you. Dressed in white shorts and a white halter top, tanned a deep olive brown, she nervously puffed on a cigarette, turning her head this way and that, scanning the street. Her hair, dyed blonde, her cheeks painted with rouge and dusted with powder, her eyes outlined in black pencil into the shape of almonds. She looked like a grown woman. But her dark eyes held a mist of tears like a halo in front of them, and her smile was still bashful. A man's ring with a smooth black stone hung from her neck on a gold chain. Patty sat down on the step beside her. What's the matter, he asked, when her eyes sweeping the street met his. I'm afraid Dennis might come looking for us. Patty's heart went cold. I thought you broke up with him. He began scanning the street himself. Dennis was one of the Springer brothers, five young hoodlums with a reputation in the neighborhood, not unlike the James brothers in the Old West. Two of Dennis's older brothers were upstate in prison. Dennis had done time as a juvenile and had the makings of a true gangster. Nancy might have been heading that way too, from what he'd heard. Patty, despite his mother's earnest efforts, had gotten into some trouble himself, picked up by the police a couple of times with the kids from Kingsbridge Avenue. His hair slicked back into a DA, wore black denim pants, and kept his pack of Lucky Strikes rolled up in the sleeve of his T-shirt. He wanted to be streetwise and tough. Nancy was silent as an L train screeched into the 231st Street station below them. They waited for the train to leave, Patty staring out over the top of the train across the valley and the Major Deegan Expressway to Bailey Avenue, where Nancy lived and where the hills cluttered with apartment buildings climbed toward the East Bronx. The train lumbered out of the station and a clatter died in the distance. Moved by some power, the action compelled by the plaintive look in her eyes rather than willed by him, he reached his arm gently around her shoulder. As if she'd been waiting for him, as if it were the next movement in a dance, Nancy nestled into the crook of his arm and they kissed. His eyes blurred and he tasted the sweetness of her mouth when she sat back against the railing and entwined her fingers in his. It's funny, Nancy said. I had a crush on you when I first met you. I planned all week so I could come to your apartment that time. Remember? Patty reddened, remembering. I thought my mother, your mother, boy. Nancy frowned. She scared me away. I shouldn't have let her, she said thoughtfully. But I was a kid. She took his hand in both of hers and pressed it against her chest. They kissed and caressed on the stoop while life on Broadway droned on below them. L trains came and L trains left. With Nancy in his arms and her mouth caressing his, At first gently and then more feverishly, Patty fell into a swoon. Then she stiffened beside him, as if she had realized something, recognized that they'd made a wrong turn, were on the wrong road, that things were not as she had thought they were. "You better go," she said. "Dennis will find us." There was that plaintive look in her eyes again, and he didn't know if she wanted him to go or stay. It was as if she knew something and wanted him to know too, but wasn't able to tell him. He couldn't keep up with her. He took her hand in his. They stood. She watched him with that strange expression. She said again, "You better go." It was too late. They came up the stone stairs from Broadway, two men in white t-shirts and black denim pants, both with dark Vaseline slicked back hair, determined, taking the steps two at a time, hurrying. Nancy stiffened. Patty took a step away from her. "Get out of here, Dennis," Nancy shouted. She ripped the chain from her neck and threw it at him. He caught it against his chest. "What are you doing with my girl?" Dennis came straight at him, swiftly, certainly. "I didn't know." Patty stepped back from him, his knees weak. Nancy grabbed Dennis's arm before he could get off the punch that Patty had already braced for, almost already absorbed. "Stop, Dennis. Leave him alone. I'll go with you. Let's just go. Leave him alone. He didn't know." Watching her tug at Dennis, Patty felt, as he had that night in the basement, that he should do something to keep her. But he didn't move, didn't speak. Let's go," Nancy said. It wasn't his fault. Nancy continued to talk and tug at Dennis's arm, and his resistance began to weaken. He followed her, she pulling on his arm, he resisting, yelling threats at Patty, so she had to struggle as she dragged them along Naples Terrace. After leaving Larry Porter's apartment, Patty Riley didn't work the discos, the rock and roll bars, or the after-hour joints as he usually did at night. Instead, he walked the streets alone, carrying with him a mind's eye picture of the teenage girl with big dark eyes, very red lipstick, and a motorcycle jacket that was too big for her. Coked up, he swaggered along Broadway, dressed in designer jeans, his wavy black hair brushed back to his shoulders, hip, wearing a pale blue shirt that matched his eyes, open to his chest. He nodded to folks on the street and rapped with the hookers at 83rd Street. The ones he talked to would tell the others. Word got around. He was a dealer, a big spender, a cool guy. He had a rep. At 86th Street, he grabbed a Broadway local, the milk train to the Bronx, and rode it to the end of the line. When the train stopped at 231st Street, he leaned back in his seat so he could look out the window at the concrete steps that led up to where Naples Terrace dead-ended against the stone wall. When he left the train at 242nd Street, he walked around the old neighborhood for the first time in years, stopping in at the terminal, Gallagher's and Keenan's. Later, for a long time, he stood at the top of the stairs on Naples Terrace that led to Broadway. He slept that night at his folks' house on 238th Street, calling and waking his mother at 2 a.m., staggering in around 4 after breakfast at Arthur's Diner. Stumbling through the kitchen, he felt like a giant, as if everything had been built for someone smaller, as if the house had shrunk, for he had grown tremendously. As he lay in bed in the room that had been his in childhood, he thought about Nancy, about Mary Sheehan, who married a drunk like her mother had before her and lived a few blocks up Broadway from where she grew up, about Dennis Springer, convicted under Rockefeller's drug law and serving 15 to life. He recalled himself not long back from Vietnam, drunk in Keenan's bar, listening to Lumps Gannon talk about his job. It's not like it was in my old man's day, Gannon said. They want guys on the force who know what it's like on the street. A new breed of cop, Lumps told him, who knew kids, who remembered what it was like to get holed in by the cops when you hadn't done anything wrong. Cops could do good in the world, too, Lumps said. So Betty gave up the GI Bill, dropped out of Fordham, and entered the police academy. When he awoke in the late morning, he visited Lumps, who lived with his wife and three boys in Riverdale. Sporting a beer paunch, his hairline receded, Lumps looked 10 years older than Patty. These days he worked the precinct desk. "You look terrible," he told Patty when they sat down together on the stoop. "I had a rough night." Lumps wouldn't ask Patty about his work. He forgot about him when he disappeared from the precinct, knowing it was better for Patty. And he wouldn't ask about his habits out of some version of loyalty. "I got a bust coming down and I don't like it." "A bad rap?" "No." Patty wiped his nose with a tissue. It was stuffed up from the night before and he'd been trying to unclog it all morning. "The guys are heavy, but there's a girl who might go down with him who maybe shouldn't." Gannon said nothing. "She's from the neighborhood. I used to know her. You did too. Nancy Sheridan." His friend nodded. "That's no surprise. She's hung with the bad guys a long time. I don't want to lock her up. She's a junkie. You're a cop, not a social worker." Patty turned on him. "You said we were going to help people." Lumps looked confused. "What?" Patty shook his head. There was no way to explain. Lumps put his hand on his friend's shoulder. "You've been under long enough, Patty. Make the collar and get out. Guys stay too long, it gets to them. They turn." "You remember Nancy?" Patty tried again. "Come back up. Work in the precinct. Retire in a few years. You don't got to be a hero. You don't got to save the world." The next night, Patty Riley went to the Hilton on 6th Avenue near Rockefeller Center, where the surveillance team report said Nancy worked. He sat at the corner of the bar next to the waitress station. It wasn't until her second trip to the service bar that she noticed him. First, she smiled because he watched her. When she recognized him, her face brightened. "Hi," she said cheerfully. "What are you doing here?" "I came to see you," he said. She grimaced, a skeptical expression, as if this were the last thing in the world she'd believe. "I kind of left you in the lurch yesterday," she said. "Sorry about drifting away. I was having a good time." Patty ordered another vodka on the rocks. "You waiting for someone?" Nancy asked the next time she came back to the service bar. "For you." The skeptical expression again. Then she believed him. The flirtatious look came back. She knew he was about to drop 30 grand on Larry Porter. He was dangerous, a little bit wild and cool. So was she. When she got off work, they walked across 59th Street, alongside the park, past the horse-drawn carriages, through Columbus Circle and up Broadway. She hugged his arm as they walked. "You're a strange man, Patrick Grace. I feel like I've known you for ages." Dressed fashionably, pink rouge high on her cheeks, bright red lipstick, loose black slacks that tied at her ankles and drifted around her legs like harem pants, spiked high-heeled shoes, Nancy still attracted stares from men she walked past. Wrinkles had formed in the corner of her eyes and around her mouth, but the eyes were dark and misty still, and her face angelic when she smiled. When they stopped for a drink at a sidewalk cafe across from Lincoln Center and sat looking across at the white fountain, the floodlit, elegant buildings, the giant red and gold Chagall paintings, and the raindrop chandeliers, he told her he was not Patrick Grace, but Patty Riley, and she had in fact known him for years. "My God," Nancy cried out, "I knew there was something about you." 20 years. She shook her head. 20 years and you remembered me. That's so sweet, I could cry. She reached across the table and took his hand in hers. They spoke of the old days in the Bronx and the folks they had known as if they hailed from a small town in Iowa. Everything changed, Nancy said, when the boys went to the war. For the first time in years, Patty remembered the bitterness coming home, realizing he'd carried the load for so many people who wouldn't shoulder it, knowing he'd been a sucker. He felt the same way now as a cop, bitter, paying for everyone else's mistakes, so they could ignore the mess they made, getting nothing for it, a sucker all over again. When Nancy excused herself to go to the ladies' room, he watched the traffic crisscrossing in front of Lincoln Center. He was nuts to have told her who he was, yet he was thrilled. Someone looking out from the bar would see him glowing like a lamp. The crush he'd had on her came back, as it had every time he thought about her over the years. And it had been often. Nights prowling the South Bronx in a squad car. Times he sat hunched over in a doorway, a weak stubble on his chin. On stakeout in the East Village, or stood in front of the shell of a burned-out building junkies used for a shooting gallery. Sometimes for his entire shift. You're as pretty as I remember you, he told her when she came back. I'm crazy about you all over again. She leaned close to him, her smile mischievous. Patty Riley, are you flirting with me? The rest of the evening passed. They spoke softly, after a while moving indoors, where Nancy sat beside him in a booth, their bodies touching. Patty would be happy if he never left, if they stayed there forever. Finally, Nancy told him she had to go. We're crazy doing this, she said. Larry would kill both of us. Patty walked her out to the street where she hailed a cab. Before she got into it, they kissed gently. That's what I remember about you, Nancy said before she pushed herself away from his arms. How gentle you were. The evening of the bust, he went to catch her before she went to work. At midnight, he and Larry were to meet a man in a parking lot. Patty would dive behind a car and Larry would be locked up or gunned down because the alleys and roofs and the cars parked in the lot would be overflowing with cops from the 20th Precinct and the Joint Task Force. He haunted the streets between 72nd and 79th Street, Amsterdam, Columbus, Broadway, near Larry Porter's apartment, knowing he'd find her. And he did, around 8:30 on 79th Street. Hey, he called when he saw her. She glanced back, half-interested, half-distrusting. Recognizing him, she flashed her cockeyed smile. Hey, Nancy, he said, putting on his style. She hesitated. I'm supposed to meet Larry. He won't mind. He'd kill you, she laughed. Closer to her now, his hand shot out and clamped on her forearm. Nancy jumped in surprise, more than pain, but silently, as if she knew the drill. I've got to talk to you. He spoke through clenched teeth. Okay, okay, she said. Cool it. I'm a friend. He steered her across the street and into a bar, a dark, dank, shot and beer joint with a long mahogany bar and bare-boned wooden booths across from the bar. No one paid them any mind. He put her in a booth and went to the bar where he drank a shot of straight vodka before bringing a double in a rock glass over to the table, along with Nancy's screwdriver. They sat at a scarred table facing one another across a marble aisle from old men nursing draft beers at the bar. He threw back his drink as Nancy searched his face. Before she could say anything, he leaned toward her and grabbed both her wrists. Be cool and listen. I'm a cop, Nancy. She shuddered. Instinctively, she tried to stand and run in the same motion, but he had her wrists. She gave a half-hearted lunge against his grip, then collapsed back into the booth. Her eyes grew larger, but not with fear, not anger either, nor hate, but cunning, like you'd see in a cornered animal. "Don't try to leave," Patty said, and went to the bar for two more drinks, even though she hadn't touched hers. Back again, he hunched over the table. She was calmer. "You're gonna bust Larry?" Patty nodded. "There's no way out of it?" Patty shook his head. "He's not such a bad guy. Someone downtown wants him." Patty threw back the vodka. "You're gonna get drunk." Her tone was gruff, protective. "Maybe," he answered. But the next drink he got on the rocks and sipped. "I didn't think cops were supposed to drink on the job." "Lots of things cops ain't supposed to do." He couldn't keep his eyes off her, the halo in front of her eyes, and a smile, as thin and timid as it was, that lit up the musty gin mill. He sat hunched over the table. She watched him as he watched her. "You want to get paid?" Patty shook his head. "I want you to disappear. Larry's going down. Nothing can stop it. He's not a bad guy." It sounded automatic, as if she was used to defending him. "He's a killer." "He is not." She drank her screwdriver in a couple of long swallows. Patty got them another round. "Why are you doing this? Why are you telling me?" She glared at him across the table. For 2 days, he'd asked himself the same question. He knew the answer now, but not so that he could tell her. Not yet. "Can't you let us both go?" "I can't." "Oh, please, please," Nancy begged. "Let us both go." She reached out and took his hand in hers. There were tears in her eyes. "We're going to get clean." "No, you're not." His heart sank. He'd been wrong. "Don't go back to Larry," he said, and heard the panic rising in his voice. "What if I do? Nothing's going to help him. You got to take care of yourself. That's why I'm telling you. Larry will get busted. If not tonight, then tomorrow or the next day. It's over for him." Her eyes were blank. She wasn't listening. When she stood, he stood also, hoping against the truth coming to him. He lifted her chin gently and kissed her mouth. She stood stiffly and didn't respond or resist. Her mouth was cold. It was like hitting someone who didn't fight back. "You want that to let Larry go?" Patty shook his head. When she left, he moved from the table to the bar and switched from vodka to draft beer. For 3 hours, he sipped beer without leaving his bar stool except to go to the men's room. She might understand when she had time to think, he told himself. She'd split, leave Larry behind, call him from the village or Miami or the coast, telling him she was waiting for him. Things might turn out right. There was a chance. He was drunk when the time came to make his move. Whatever would happen next, he didn't need to be sober for it. Unsteadily, he walked down the 2 steps from the bar to the sidewalk. He took a couple more steps toward the street before he saw the black car at the curb, saw the window roll down. All 6 of the bullets went into his chest. He died half in the street and half on the sidewalk, draped over the curb.
Come Back Patty Riley is copyrighted by Con Lehane. Music for this podcast is by Daniel Birch and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at ellerycreenmysterymagazine.com.